Welcome to How to Get on a Watch List, the new podcast series from Encyclopedia Geopolitica. In each episode, we'll sit down with leading experts to discuss dangerous activities. From assassinations and airliner shootdowns through to kidnappings and coups, we'll examine each of these threats through the lenses of both the dangerous actors seeking to conduct these operations and the agencies around the world seeking to stop them.
In the interest of operational security, certain tactical details will be omitted from these discussions. However, the cases and threats which we discuss here are very real.
I'm Lewis H. Passant, the founder and co-editor of Encyclopedia Geopolitica. I'm a researcher in the field of intelligence and espionage with a PhD in intelligence studies from Loughborough University. I'm an adjunct professor in intelligence at Sciences Po Paris, and in my day job, I provide geopolitical analysis and security-focused intelligence to private sector corporations.
My name is Colin Reed. I am a former U.S. intelligence professional now working in the private sector to bring geopolitical insights and risk analysis to business leaders.
In this episode, we'll be discussing how to run a troll farm. Now, the field of fake news is a big, confused one, with many actors and commentators struggling to understand and identify the various kinds of influence operations, smear campaigns, and outright trolling that make up the modern information ecosystem. So to sort order from this apparent chaos, we've invited two guests to help us define the state of the field, contextualize the different kinds of threat present in the landscape, and to understand how various actors are seeking to combat the problem.
Our first guest is Olga Belgolova. Olga is the director of the Emerging Technologies Initiative at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She's also a professor at the Alperovitch Institute for Cybersecurity Studies at SAIS, where she teaches a course on disinformation and influence in the digital age. At Facebook Meta, she led policy for countering influence operations, leading execution and development of policies on coordinated inauthentic behavior, state media capture, and hack and leaks within the trust and safety team. Prior to that, she led threat intelligence work on Russia and Eastern Europe at Facebook, identifying, tracking, and disrupting coordinated IO campaigns, and in particular, the Internet Research Agency investigations between 2017 and 2019. Olga previously worked as a journalist, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, National Journal, Inside Defense, and The Globe and Mail, among others. She's a fellow with the Truman National Security Project and serves on the review board for CyberWorkOn.
Regina Morales is the principal of Telescope Research, where she conducts investigations on behalf of law firms, multinational corporations, financial institutions, and not-for-profit organizations. She has subject matter expertise in Latin American politics, corruption issues, extremism, and disinformation. In particular, Regina specializes in investigating disinformation campaigns waged on social media platforms, forums, and certain messaging apps. These campaigns include online harassment, corporate disinformation relating to securities, conspiracy theories, and politically, ideologically driven campaigns. She has seen often in real time how the theoretical components of disinformation and propaganda are used in practice. Prior to founding Telescope Research, Regina worked for two top-tier chambers and partners-ranked global investigative firms, where she conducted and managed complex multi-jurisdictional investigations on behalf of white shoe law firms and multinational companies. Olga and Regina, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, both of you, for having me as well.
So we always start with this question, and we'll start with Olga and then Regina, you as well. How did you get into your line of work?
So I'm originally from Ukraine. I was born in Kyiv, technically born in the Soviet Union. So I guess you can say I was born into this field in some way. It all makes sense looking backwards. And, you know, as was mentioned earlier, I did work as a journalist and I had worked in the field of information. And then I went on to study warfare. And so those two things really came together as information warfare, one of the many terms that we might talk about later. And I, you know, finished graduate school, absolutely expected that I was going to go work in sort of the national security field in government. And then, you know, the 2016 election happened and all of a sudden, you know, I was really interested in what was happening and talking to people about it and figuring out what they were doing about it, whether they were people in defense roles or in social media companies or at think tanks doing research into this space. And the field was relatively limited at the time. And so I just talked to anyone who would talk to me. And eventually I met someone who worked for the threat intelligence team at Meta, or the company formerly known as Facebook. And the rest is history.
Regina, how about you?
Yeah, so I kind of went about it in a very tangential way. I actually studied music in undergrad and international studies. So definitely not a normal path for a music major, for a performance major. But I did study corruption issues in graduate school, and I had an interest in the space where private sector and government meet. I grew up between Illinois and Bolivia, two places that have been rife with corruption in different ways. You know, as many listeners may know, Illinois has a history of corruption in politics, and, you know, multiple governors have faced charges of corruptions and other forms of fraud. And in Bolivia, you know, corruption is more of a daily life occurrence. It's very difficult to get things done without paying some sort of bribe or facilitation payment. So that's sort of the where I wanted to go in terms of my studies. Now, while I was in graduate school, I interned at an anti-money laundering think tank. And the executive director noted that I had a knack for investigating and investigations, and told me about the investigations industry and political risk consulting sort of more broadly. So I started looking for a job in that industry, in private sector instead of government. I knew I wanted to work in private sector. So I started my career at a political risk consultancy that also conducted investigations primarily in emerging markets. This was a shop started by former intelligence officials, intelligence officers, and really focused a lot on like human source intelligence. I worked on many interesting cases, including cases where different sides were giving conflicting narratives in press and on social media. And this was particularly in like West Africa, Latin America, 2014-2015 timeline. So this is sort of when I started kind of diving into this sort of realm of political disinformation. I then went on to work at a global investigations firm that's headed by former federal prosecutors. So different type of sort of investigations from a different angle. Here, worked primarily on long-term litigation cases, finding facts and evidence to bolster the case. And the disinformation research that I did at this company was really as it affected the private sector. So again, really focused on private sector and the ways that misinformation have affected these companies, their bottom line, things like this. So one of the things that, you know, with corruption and sort of this misinformation, a lot of the, in terms of the intent for disinformation, these campaigns are usually driven by profit or power. So there's sort of like a kind of very similar dovetail with corruption and disinformation in terms of like what motivates people to do these acts. But that's sort of my story. Not a very linear one, but yeah.
Well, two very fascinating backgrounds there. So Olga, you teach extensively on this topic, and like any good professor, you've been very adamant when we've been planning this episode that everyone in the conversation needs to get the terminology correct, something I can certainly appreciate. So help us set the stage here. When we talk about malinformation, misinformation, disinformation, you know, I hear these terms being used interchangeably all the time, and you know, I can see that that's not the case. So when we talk about influence operations and this type of information warfare, what do we mean?
So this is one of my favorite topics to talk about. In fact, sometimes I get made fun of by my colleagues because I go on these rants about, you know, when people use these terminology incorrectly, when they say things like misdisinformation, because that doesn't mean anything really. And the reason I care about that is because we can't possibly get our responses to these problems right if we don't actually fight the same things, or we don't identify the problems that we are specifically trying to address. And so there's a couple different frameworks that I think are useful to understanding the terminology in the space. There's much, much more detail that we can get into, but I'll try to, you know, keep it short. One thing to get out of the way really quickly is fake news is a fundamentally useless term, right? It's something that now really just means I don't like that, and now I'm going to call it fake news. It's more of a joke than anything else at this point in time. But the terms that are most often used, including in our conversation so far, are misinformation and disinformation. And the distinction between them is really rooted in the words, right? Misinformed, right? Your friend, your colleague, your uncle might be someone who just doesn't know any better and truly believes something to be true. And so they are merely misinformed, which is distinct from disinformation because it is the intentional sharing of false information. And those things are important. Intent is not always easy to divine, but you have to understand that those two words mean different things and you can't use them interchangeably or in some cases meld them into one word together because intent is the distinction. And when you're thinking about what you do about these problems, right, you know, Regina mentioned conspiracy theorists. They are often people who are misinformed. They have gone down certain rabbit holes and they don't know something any better. There are certainly people that do know what they're doing and they're trying to sort of spread a particular conspiracy theory. So you want to sort of treat differently the person that is sort of the victim versus the perpetrator of sharing false information. But both misinformation and disinformation are content-based terms. What do I mean by that? Content is, you know, you're making a decision whether something is true or false based on what you see in front of you. It could be words, it could be an image of some kind, right? You're trying to assess whether it's true or it's false. That's a binary. But ultimately, when we are talking about this field and the way I got into it in the first place, we were largely talking about troll farms, the name of this episode. And troll farms are not necessarily focused on disseminating false content. They are campaign-based. So when you use campaign-based terminology, you can use terms like influence operations, information operations, or the historical term for what the Soviet Union did during the Cold War, which is active measures. Those are campaign-based terms. You're thinking holistically about a lot of things that may or may not use false information in their campaigns. And so that distinction can be really important, in particular because if we think about the most famous example, which we'll be talking about later, the Internet Research Agency. Most of what they did was actually disseminate, you know, legitimate news outlets, websites, and all of that, and not necessarily false content. And that's a common misconception. So I prefer to use the term influence operations. A few other quick distinctions to make: financially motivated operations versus politically motivated ones. So there are certainly campaigns out there that, you know, are trying to deceive someone for political gain, trying to manipulate the information environment associated with either a government or a political party. But a lot of things that look to the casual observer, like an influence campaign or a troll farm, are really financially motivated campaigns, people trying to make money off of sharing false information or getting someone to just click on a flashy page and, you know, get some clicks and likes. And finally, last distinction is covert versus overt influence. We can talk about, you know, troll farms. But we can also talk about state-controlled media outlets where people are not necessarily creating false personas. There are journalists who are working for a government-sponsored media organization, and they are doing work on behalf of the government. And that can be things like propaganda, which in and of itself is a neutral term. It just means the dissemination of information that is on behalf of a government or some other organization that is favorable to it. And that can be done by anybody. But the term over time has sort of gained a negative connotation.
So, Regina, let's turn to you now and talk about the various actors in this space. What are the differences between the nation-state actors versus maybe extremist groups or individuals?
Yeah, so when most people think of sort of culprits in the space pushing disinformation narratives, they think of nation states. But other groups and individual actors participate in the space as well, as Olga had mentioned. These can be, you know, to push narratives to meet their goals, whether that's, you know, for power or profit. Sometimes the narrative that they're pushing begins within the group. You know, many times it's actually that they latch onto an existing narrative in like the online eco space and then amplify it in order to achieve their goals. And in terms of, you know, extremists, particularly in the US, this can be for profit or for power. So there are instances where it's both. They might be trying to generate clicks, likes, but also sometimes they're pushing products or donations, but they're also pushing a message as well. One of the other examples that I really like to give and kind of how I got started in the space was through investigating short sellers. So these are, you know, people that short a stock of a publicly traded company and then seek to drive down the stock by putting out information. Particularly in this case, we're looking at false information that would help drive down the stock. So that is also, you know, a for-profit sort of enterprise in terms of a campaign that you would see online. So it's not only nation states, but, you know, it can be individuals, it can be groups, political, ideological groups, it can be political parties, it can be other, just other types of groups. It can be like religious groups, all kinds of, you know, any kind of community online, really.
So let's take this back. Olga, you mentioned this started for you after the US presidential election in 2016 and the Russian effort that took place there. Talk to us about the situation that occurred then and give us a bit of a scene setter for that.
Yeah, of course. So importantly, you could argue that there were probably two or even three distinct types of Russian influence campaigns in the US in the lead up to the 2016 election. They often get blurred together in public discourse. And again, I like to make the distinctions between what we're talking about to be clear. So the first one is Russian military intelligence, or the GRU, and the hack and leak campaign to steal private information and then use fake accounts, but also sort of more direct methods of disseminating that information to journalists and to others and getting that information published and creating fake websites and other things like that to disseminate that information as well. The overt side, which I mentioned earlier, is state-controlled media outlets like Sputnik and RT and other subsidiary outlets that people are not necessarily sure or familiar with the fact that they are controlled by that same government to, you know, share information about what was happening in the United States and, you know, catchy headlines that get people to read something. And the most infamous effort is the Internet Research Agency campaign. And that's the one that I have the most familiarity with because it is what I spent my time doing in the early days on the intelligence team at Facebook. So what is the Internet Research Agency? Importantly, it's actually not a government effort, right? It's a troll farm in St. Petersburg, Russia that had been in operation since at least 2013. And it was initially targeting domestic audiences in Russia. And importantly, you know, as I said, it wasn't a government effort. It was a rich oligarch, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is no longer with us, according to public reporting, who had friends in the government, but did not work for the government and had, you know, contracts, military contracts and other things with the government for catering and with Wagner Group. So another, you know, common misconception is that these efforts were designed to benefit a particular candidate or party. But if you actually look at the substance of the campaigns themselves, as I have as an investigator, you'll see that they covered both ends of the political spectrum and appear to be more so designed to drive wedges in society further rather than promoting particular agendas. And I think that's important to point out because, you know, again, a lot of the conversation around this centers on, you know, electoral outcomes or a particular agenda. But really, if you look at the substance of these campaigns, you'll see that they were more focused on posting memes that were divisive politically. And again, on both ends of the political spectrum, they had Blue Lives Matter pages, Black Lives Matter pages. They had, you know, pages that were supportive of guns and not supportive of guns. And so all kinds of things on both ends of the political spectrum. As I alluded to earlier, you know, they actually did share quite a bit of content that was not necessarily false, right? Some of the most shared links on Twitter were NewYorkTimes.com. And so this common misconception that they were creating lots of fake domains and creating fake websites to share false content is actually not true. They were actually using, you know, existing information that was out there. Again, not that different from what we saw during the Cold War with the Soviet active measures, where they really used a lot of real things that were happening in society, right? The problems that they leveraged weren't, you know, problems that they invented, right? We have civil rights issues in the United States of America. We have a lot of other divisive political issues that they just took advantage of. They did not invent them. So the content piece is important because it's one of the reasons I sort of warn people off of using content-driven investigative techniques, because you know, it can prove harmful, and also sort of you end up thinking that something is actually a campaign when it's not, or it's legitimate people that are just sharing, you know, accurate information. You know, I think the reason we're talking about all this is because ultimately this campaign changed this field, or in some, for better or for worse, it kind of created it, right? Sometimes joke about the concept of the disinformation industrial complex, right? You know, people have been lying for centuries, but now there's an entire industry surrounding, you know, this. And sometimes, you know, my course name when I was first started teaching at Georgetown was called Lies, Damn Lies, and Disinformation. And it was a bit of a joke, but it's also, you know, a play on the terminology and a play on the fact that, you know, this isn't a new problem, right? We, you know, people have been lying for a long time. It's just that now the term disinformation is really sexy, so everybody's talking about it.
So, Regina, can you tell us about some of the other government actors that are active in this space that our listeners might not be as familiar with? You know, this idea of the kind of 2016 elections and then the French elections the following year in 2017, you know, they're big cases that got talked about a lot. But what are some of the other cases out there that people maybe don't know as well?
Yeah, so many nation states participate in these types of campaigns. It's not exclusive to like the, you know, the big bad actors like Russia. There's obviously like Venezuela is known to participate, especially in the domestic sense. Iran has a history of also participating in influence campaigns throughout the Middle East and South Asia. You know, during COVID-19, China appears to have pushed in narratives related to COVID-19 and the Hong Kong demonstrations and BLM protests in the US. However, they were, you know, pushing, you know, pro-China narratives. I don't think that anybody like, you know, fully was able to attribute it to the state, but it's possible and it is maybe likely since they were pro-China narratives, but again, inconclusive. There's also been reporting about pro-Western, pro-US narratives in the Middle East and parts of Asia from inauthentic actors on social media, particularly Twitter. So it's not like, you know, this isn't just Russia that does this. Many, many nation states participate in this, and they often participate through proxies. So it is difficult to attribute directly to them, especially from a private sector perspective and non-government perspective, where you don't have access to subpoena power and things like this, or other tools at your disposal. But definitely want to emphasize that Russia is not the only one doing this.
So we talked a little bit about the nation states involved in this. Olga, I wonder now if we can talk about the methods available to those nation states to run these influence campaigns. We've talked a lot about the Internet Research Agency in the context of the troll farm, right? But how effective was the IRA's work? And is that sort of the only methodology that nation states deploy?
I'll answer the last question first, which is definitely not. So we talked about overt versus covert influence. Nation states deploy, you know, they have a lot of different tools at their disposal to influence. And you can actually go back. And one of the things I share with my students in class is a testimony from Bob Gates during the 1980s in front of, I believe, the House Foreign Relations Committee about what they had analyzed the Soviet Union to be doing. And they break things up into covert and overt influence and some of the different types of active measures that the Soviet Union was engaged in. And they included things like reaching out to individuals and having sort of agents of influence. There's a lot of different ways in which nation states can influence one another and influence populations in their respective countries. And they are not limited to running a troll farm. They include things like, you know, overt state-controlled media outlets and other, you know, things that are connected directly to the state in the public domain. And of course, you know, all kinds of relationships, diplomacy efforts. You can think, you know, Regina mentioned China. So you can think about the Confucius Institutes and things like that, where there are diplomacy efforts that many different nation states undertake in order to try to, you know, make people more favorable to their particular country. So we can talk about the concept of whether, you know, influence is always malign, right? There's a lot of different, everyone's trying to tell their story and trying to tell it effectively. And where does it cross the line into being malign? And that's where the work that, you know, I have done into things like troll farms is where we can sort of draw a particular line in the sand and say, when people are pretending to be someone that they're not, then that can be a red line, right? Building false personas and pretending to be part of some sort of activist group that they're not in. So in practice, you know, you're talking about governments, but a troll farm is not all too different from a marketing agency or an advocacy group's headquarters in and of itself, which is a complicated factor when you're conducting investigations into them, because if you're looking for one, you will likely find the other. But really, what is it? It's a group of people, often young people with social media skills, marketing degrees, English degrees, depending on what country they're in, who often work in the same building, often in shifts. They're creating false personas, pretending to be people that they are not, and creating content, joining communities, often existing communities, amplifying often existing content and issues like we discussed, reaching out to journalists to try and other influential figures to try to drive their specific agendas. To the question about how effective they are, that's a good question, because not a lot of people have actually been able to definitively prove that. And it's actually quite a difficult thing to do. Put it this way, how do you know that some meme of Jesus wrestling Hillary Clinton that someone saw on their newsfeed on a social media platform for about 5 seconds had an impact on their political views and decisions? You don't. And there, you know, there's a number of different proxies that people try to use to understand whether these things are impactful, but they're perfect and they're imperfect and they're all flawed in their own ways. So one proxy is numbers and reach, right? A lot of the conversation tends to center around, well, how many accounts did they create and how many people viewed them and for how long and how many friends did they have? Right? Those are things that can help us, because we are in a data-driven world, to try to make sense of it. But they're flawed because ultimately, if you are just focusing on numbers, there's a lot of campaigns that my team back at Meta saw that were really big and then no one saw them, right? They created a whole bunch of accounts and got no traction. And then there's some campaigns that had 2 to 3 accounts, but they actually reached an influential person, got them to do something or share a news story for them. And that actually had more of an impact than anything else. And so it's not always the best proxy to use. A more complicated one is, you know, as I said, whether a real individual took the bait and someone actually disseminated that information for them. Some researchers in this space, including Alicia Wanless and Kate Starbird, talk about participatory disinformation or the sort of participatory space in which this takes place, because ultimately, this is not, you know, television, this is not radio, this is a participatory environment online where everybody's communicating with one another all the time. And that's what, you know, fundamentally makes a lot of this different.
So let's move away from the government context now, and I'd like to hear from both of you. Let's talk about the extremist actors and the individual actors that are out there propagating these mis- and disinformation narratives. Can we talk about their methodologies, the tools they use that might be different to those that we've already discussed that nation states deploy?
So I can start on the government side. Aside from, you know, government, you've got privately run troll farms, like we discussed, that maybe have some government ties. You have financially motivated troll farms that are just trying to make money off of clicks, like the Macedonians. And then you have non-state actors, political parties, advocacy groups, and private companies that all have, you know, an incentive, as Regina mentioned earlier, to, you know, share their story, both using methods than any marketing agency or promotional organization would use, as well as more nefarious techniques like creating fake accounts. The distinction between them, which I made earlier that I think is important, is if you can sort of think about what someone's incentives are, then you might be able to more effectively address them, take, for example, Macedonian troll farms. If they are trying to drive someone to their website, which is the point of sale where they will get make money off of the clicks that are on that website, then they're going to be trying to get your attention away from a social media platform and onto the place where they'll be able to make money. So when you think about that from the perspective of an investigator, it's going to look a little bit different on a network graph when you're doing analysis than a troll farm that is just trying to keep your attention, build a relationship with you. You're going to have more longer running personas and relationship building that these troll farms invest into than perhaps someone who is just interested in getting you go somewhere else. And so a lot of that, you know, the techniques will look different to an investigator and also, you know, the guys that are engaging in these campaigns in the first place.
Regina, please jump in.
Yeah, so in terms of the way things look, I think it's one thing that an effective campaign will look very similar to what a normal conversation, an organic conversation will look like on a particular platform online. So I'll give a couple of examples and one sort of more recent example and, well, they're both semi-recent and haven't really been discussed, let's say, in media, but it was something that we noticed in 2022 that anti-government extremists, particularly in the US, in a sort of a quote-unquote post-pandemic space, a lot of these existing channels and existing groups online that were previously anti-COVID mandate and pushing these sort of false narratives there began pushing a new narrative about food shortages, and that governments and big agra were pushing food shortages in 2022. And this narrative initially spread on platforms such as Gab and .win communities. But as Olga mentioned, it was promoted in a more like mainstream sense on Tucker Carlson, and which further amplified these narratives in those initial spaces on Gab and the .win communities, like as like a sort of a verification of the narrative, and then also spread to more mainstream platforms. Now, whether some of these channels on Telegram that were pushing this, you know, also push ideas of parallel economy, this is something that's very big within the extremist community. These are also anti-corporate sort of channels. These were ones that were pushing sort of the anti-Bud Light, the anti-Target, anti-Disney type of messages, you know, from earlier this year and even, you know, in the years past. And one of the questions that, you know, I haven't done this investigation, but in thinking about from the short seller toolkit, the ways that short sellers would push narratives to drive down stock prices, you would see somewhat similar things here. Within these communities, these extremist communities, they would talk about the stock price of some of these companies that they were targeting, and that these narratives that they were pushing, saying that we should boycott, you know, Bud Light, Budweiser, Anheuser-Busch, and following the stock prices falling. Same thing with Target, same thing with Disney. I don't know if there was any sort of short seller campaign tied along with this, but I think it would be an interesting thing to look at, as I think there's been quite a bit of movement since, you know, the Reddit sort of GameStop community that kind of built up during the pandemic.
Well, let's just stick with this idea of sock puppets versus bots. What do we mean when we use these terms in the information ecosystem? You know, how do these augment these actual humans that you've both been talking about that are seeking to kind of influence the environment? What do these terms mean, and how are they used?
So I can start really quickly. I mean, I think it's important. The word bot comes from the word robot, right? And a lot of people forget that. You know, depending on what country you are in the world, people will use the term and bot and troll interchangeably. And that can also in and of itself be problematic, because ultimately when you're thinking about trolls and troll farms, there's a lot more effort being put into developing a persona, right? There's a person behind the computer and they are spending some time to try to backstop their persona. They are maybe creating a website or they're creating multiple social media profiles that look the same so that when someone goes to dig around and say, okay, well, is this a real person? Let me see if I can find them on LinkedIn or find them somewhere else. And then, you know, and then they'll have a bit of more information that they can find in other places. That takes effort. That takes time. And, you know, you need to buy a pack of SIMs, you know, use a phone number to create a fake account, create an email address, build up the profile of all of that. That's, you know, that's the what trolls do at troll farms. Bots, of course, are artificially generated. And, you know, some platforms completely block efforts to create bots. And it's easier for an artificial intelligent platform to catch, you know, catch an automated account because automation finds automation, right? There are certain triggers that you can develop to say, okay, well, these are all the different things that we've seen previously with a fake account. So let's find more like them, right? Because you're training a computer to find things that look like a computer. So that's an important distinction there is, you know, bots versus trolls and, you know, people actually spending time to develop a persona or not.
I think with bots, particularly on social media, you know, it refers to like a program that is designed to automate interactions. So these can be innocuous, such as like the bot on Reddit that comments below any post that like contains all the necessary components of a haiku, something like this. It can also be informative. There's a bot on Twitter that will tweet out every time a filing in a like a very important federal case in U.S. District Court is filed, and that's a bot. There are other bots that, you know, are amplifying a particular message or narrative in the form of a campaign. And these are usually in the form of like a retweet or a reply. Bots are, you know, they can be particularly spammy. They can be very easy to detect. The more difficult type of actor is the sock puppet account, which is something that you would, you know, a troll farm is usually a one person at a troll farm might control several different sock puppet accounts. And sometimes those sock puppet accounts are all talking to each other. So they like form a community or they're part of a larger community. And it's a way to mitigate detection on behalf of the social media, you know, on behalf of the social media platforms that they're operating on, and also to mimic organic conversation on these platforms. So it's definitely a more costly, a more time intensive process than just a simple bot. So I think with respect to, you know, recent campaigns that I've seen on social media with dealing with sock puppet accounts, these are much more sophisticated accounts than just spammy bots. You can detect them by using different types of statistical analysis. Olga mentioned some of these things like post volume, reply, like seeing how much they reply, how much interaction they have coming in versus going out, things like this. They're not perfect markers, but they're the ways that we have to like to analyze a campaign. And this is like kind of what we have at the moment. Other things are many of these like sock puppet accounts, particularly if they're really busy, they might participate in what's called copypasta. So they do like copy pasting techniques where like maybe one thing is like slightly different, but it's really like you see like copy pasting. And this is not a bot. This is like a real person just tweaking the word, like a certain word or a hashtag a little bit, but, you know, making sure to either tag specific accounts, mention specific narratives, you know, that are part of their goal, that sort of thing.
How is the evolution of AI technology changing the nature of the threat for you guys so far?
I would say it is and it isn't. So in many ways, AI has been used for a long time, and we either weren't just calling it that or weren't getting as excited or nervous about it as we have been over, you know, collectively as a society over the last couple months, I would say. I don't know what happened in May, but all of a sudden every workshop that I went to was about AI, and, you know, it just changed dramatically. But I've been teaching about generative techniques to create photos and video content for at least 4 years now. I took a look back at my syllabus. So I think, you know, I will say, you know, jokes aside, that the advent of generative text and sort of the public large language models have gotten people speculating about whether these things will fundamentally change this field. I am skeptical. Ultimately, these tools are precisely that. They are tools. The investigative team that I worked with at Meta wasn't focused on content or narrative-driven investigative techniques for a reason, because behavioral anomaly detection was a more important signal in our investigations than the content. And I think that keeping things in that area means that you're protecting yourself from, you know, the advent of, you know, someone's creating a whole bunch of content. That doesn't stop you from still being able to detect that they've used a false persona and created it, right? There are still methods that you can use that we've discussed here today to identify whether someone is pretending to be someone that they're not and working in shift hours and other things like that. My thesis on all of this at the moment is that large language models will more so affect and help financially motivated actors, because those are the ones that are prioritizing scale over anything else. So if you're thinking about who's going to benefit from, you're going to now be able to create lots of content more quickly, probably those guys, but not necessarily nation state threat actors or others in the sort of influence operations and troll farm game that I've seen. There are some good examples of deep fake or cheap fakes being pre-bunked, like the example of sometime in March 2022, shortly after the beginning of the invasion, second invasion of Ukraine. There was a pretty terrible fake video of Zelensky where his neck didn't quite align with his head. And it was, I would say it's a cheap fake rather than deep fake, but the Zelensky team pre-bunked it. They knew it was coming, and it was sort of a non-story. That's why we don't, you know, you probably don't even remember it. And so there's some examples of people, you know, sort of dealing with artificial intelligence in this field. It is a technique, it's a tool. I think for some threat actors, it will make their jobs easier, but for some, it's just another technique to create a fake account or to create content. I'm trying to pour some cold water on this sort of AI scare right now.
Yeah, I would agree. I think deepfakes are something to be concerned about, but especially as the technology improves. There have been, as Olga mentioned, instances of deepfakes used in campaigns, but they're quite easy to detect even with like an untrained eye. It's not there yet. The use of LLMs in bot creation has been interesting. I think, just like Olga said, for these like more profit-seeking type of campaigns, I think that's where where a person that maybe doesn't have, you know, a robust programmer to help them, you know, create their bots could certainly use an LLM for their advantage. I recently learned of a way to identify bots by searching for the error messaging. So the error messaging that comes up in a ChatGPT prompt, if you put that into an advanced Twitter search, you can start seeing where an error message from someone clearly tried to create a bot via scripting from ChatGPT. On Twitter. This is something I just learned this like 2 weeks ago from shout out to the Dutch OSINT guy, if anybody here follows him. So he taught me this. And it's been just fascinating just to see like what comes up. Obviously, these things are very easy to detect. They do come down, but they don't come down right away, which is also, you know, a later topic for later in the show. But yeah, that's been interesting, but I'm sure that things are going to improve. The technology is going to improve, especially with the deep fakes. And I think it's something that, you know, is sort of like a wait and see.
Well, you've been listening to How to Run a Troll Farm with Regina Morales and Olga Belaglova. After the break, we'll discuss how to fight back against this threat.
You have been listening to How to Get on a Watch List, the podcast series from Encyclopedia Geopolitica. If you like this show, don't forget to check out our other content at Encyclopedia Geopolitica, which you can find at howtogetonawatchlist.com, where you can find our analysis on various geopolitical issues, as well as reading lists covering topics like those discussed in the podcast. Please also consider subscribing to the podcast on your streaming platform of choice, giving us a rating, and joining our Patreon.
So, who are the regulators in this space? And in particular, given that so much of this conversation in the information environment is happening on kind of private platforms, where does government start and stop on policing speech, policing information online? And where do private entities like social media companies start?
So, we were just talking about AI, and I think it's important to mention that the U.S. government just put out an executive order on artificial intelligence, and it does include some language around, you know, the use of artificial intelligence for creating things like deepfakes and all of that. And so there are times where governments are starting to step in, especially on the AI space, in the early stages to try to understand how can these particular tools be used for harm and where can they get ahead of them. And so I think there's some lessons learned from sort of the advent of social media and places where some governments were perhaps not thinking about regulation in the early days. That said, you know, after 2016, most governments, you know, initially responded by creating task forces, setting up and standing up teams to conduct investigations, to identify these types of campaigns, intelligence teams, people to interface with different companies, to share intelligence with one another. And of course, as you mentioned, some governments have stepped up the regulatory efforts more recently. But I would sort of break down what governments are doing, both in the US and Europe and the rest of the world, into a couple different categories. So the first, which I mentioned before, investigations and intelligence. So actually doing similar work to what myself and Regina have done in different spaces and collaborating with both private and public partners that have done that work. So the collaboration piece is important. And then the other areas include things like actually crafting regulations, right? What are they going to do to try to limit the capability of social media companies and people using those social media platforms to engage in these types of activities? Those have been, you know, still in the works. Some of them have not passed in some countries. The most famous example is the Digital Services Act in Europe. And that's something that's still, you know, being understood whether it's having an impact in this space. You know, it's only really been around officially since this last summer. And then there's things like sanctions. And that's an area where I think I've seen some really effective, you know, understanding of this space from the U.S. Treasury Department, for example, where they're really looking along the kill chain of what someone is doing to run these types of campaigns and troll farms and thinking about where they can make it more difficult for these bad guys to do their jobs. So I'll give you one example. In order to create a fake account, you often need to have a fake ID. And one of the sanctioned entities by the U.S. Treasury Department was a Pakistani fake ID company that was providing fake IDs for Russian threat actors that were using them to create social media accounts. So that's a place where, you know, you can really think about driving up the cost for threat actors, making it more difficult for them to do their jobs. And the one other area that, you know, we're talking about defense, but, you know, you can also talk about offense. There are certain governments around the world that have actually gotten into the offense game. There's a couple different ways they have done so. One, you know, specific example is from 2018, ahead of the U.S. midterm elections. The Cyber Command in the United States actually disrupted service at the Internet Research Agency. Now, one can argue whether disrupting service for a day or more at a troll farm is actually going to fundamentally change anything, especially right before an election. But we can have another conversation about that. But the other side of offense is, you know, Regina mentioned this in the early days, there are, you know, governments around the world that are also getting into the an eye for an eye, you do an influence operation, I do an influence operation game. And, you know, my team back in the day at Meta actually identified a French campaign that was sort of playing ball with the Russian campaign in Francophone Africa. And the French government at the time, you know, it was attributed to the French military. And it was, they were effectively engaging in the exact same activities, right, that the Russians were doing, which is creating fake accounts, pretending to be people that they were not. And the people that were sort of caught in the middle were the people that were living in those Francophone African countries. But on both ends of the spectrum, we had the Russians and the French that were doing something. And the French government has since actually publicly come out and said, we do these things, right? We do influence operations. And some governments do them, but don't publicly acknowledge that they do, right? And so everybody's sort of playing this game, but some doing so quietly versus loudly. And there's a debate to be had about whether we should, Western nations, liberal democracies should be playing this game and doing an eye for an eye, or if you sort of lose credibility by doing what the bad guys are doing.
Olga mentioned U.S. sanctions being particularly effective. And I think in response to what is going on in Ukraine, the U.S. has amplified its sanctions against Russia and intermediaries, in particular media outlets. So this is, again, on the covert side of things, on the overt side of things. But that is, I guess, one sort of effective way that regulations, not necessarily on the social media platforms themselves, but other sort of regulatory regimes have been able to combat the problem.
So we've talked about the role of the governments. Let's move on to the social media companies and the platforms where the speech is actually being hosted. Can you talk a little bit about the upsides and the downsides of relying on those social media platforms themselves to carry out the sort of regulation and enforcement when it comes to confronting this disinformation?
So, obviously, with the caveat that I did work on a team that was doing this, and I'm quite proud of the things that we did, I think, it's a hit or miss depending on the company, right? There have been quite a few teams that have been stood up to conduct these types of investigations at Meta, historically at Twitter, when it was known as Twitter, at Reddit, at LinkedIn, at TikTok, probably forgetting a couple names at Google. And so there are threat intelligence investigative teams that have been stood up. There are policy teams that have been stood up to try to, do analysis of where they can actually take action on these problems. And I think, to the point that I made at the very beginning, the way you are effective when you are developing policies and addressing these things from a social media company's perspective is the limitations of your role, right? There are certain things that governments can do that you cannot, right? Some of the offensive actions that we talked about, or sanctions and other things like that, where you might need to rely on another partner if you are perhaps not as trusted, sharing your investigations with an independent organization so that they can help build societal resilience by sharing their own findings. So that can be really effective. And having separate policies to deal with separate problems, right? You cannot meld these things together. And that's why we had separate policies for things like coordinated and authentic behavior, which is how we dealt with troll farms, state media, which we dealt with differently, right? We labeled state-controlled media outlets as opposed to taking them down because the problem is fundamentally different. And then taking action to make it more difficult for financially motivated actors to actually make money doing what they're doing. Famously Google, changed some of the Google Ads system that was being taken advantage of by the Macedonian troll farms. And then, having distinct policies for things like misinformation and conspiracy theories, where you're actually, thinking about the sort of ways in which you can build resilience in society, get people to see fact checks and get more accurate information in front of their eyes. Those are all things that, I think are effective, but also we are still trying to understand what is effective, right? There's a lot of research in this space that is being done by the research community to try to understand, okay, well, if you did this kind of fact check, who's going to read it? Is it actually going to make a difference for someone? And that's still being studied, right? I think at this point in time, as much as we want a quick solution to a lot of these problems, we still need to actually study how human beings are reacting to the things that are being shared. Of course, there's also the, you know, political conversation where any enforcement actions, collaboration with governments and other things are now being sort of targeted by certain individuals in the United States and others as some sort of nefarious campaign to censor people. When ultimately, a lot of the people doing this work, and I know so many of them, are well-meaning individuals who are really, you know, even-handed when it comes to political bias and everything else, and really just trying to improve the information environment.
So let's talk a bit about radicalization and de-radicalization in a polluted information environment. How do we go about de-radicalizing individuals who may have been consuming bad information, sometimes for many years? And is there a success story or a model that kind of gives us a path towards, we could call it, improving our information hygiene?
You know, this is not my specialty, de-radicalization. I think it's a very, there are some very good groups and people working on this, but it's difficult. Some people aren't really open to being de-radicalized. Some people don't necessarily want to know, you know, what's real or truth or not. I don't really have a very good answer for this. One thing that was useful that I had seen firsthand with respect to like QAnon and some of the COVID-19 mandate sort of misinformation and disinformation that was spreading over the last few years is sort of this idea of not wanting to be gamed in any kind of way, that people don't like being seen as a victim or being seen as manipulated. And so the times where news had come out that a particular personality, like an online personality, you know, was a grifter or receiving a lot of payment for putting out certain types of narratives, I think that was successful in sort of maybe changing some people's minds about the content that they had internalized and thought to believe is true.
So in the first half, we talked about how private companies could be targeted by information operations sort of in and of their own selves, right, as specific targets of these things. If you're an executive of just a random corporation, right, not one that's a content provider, not a place where you're hosting this kind of stuff on your platform, what are you thinking about these inauthentic information sort of targeting operations that might come after you? What are the things you should be concerned about if you're not already concerned about them?
Yeah, I think that this is something that, you know, we've seen time and time again with private sector, non-tech, non-platform, user-generated platform, private sector, is that it's not a problem until it is a problem. And so, you know, a lot of companies aren't necessarily taking preventative measures with this, or at least coming up with a game plan. And I think that one of the things that I've seen is that with a lot of these, you know, large corporates, you know, different areas of the corporation are so siloed. So this is security, HR, communications, PR, like legal departments should all kind of come together to come up with a plan if in the event that they end up being the target of some sort of coordinated campaign online. And often, you know, these things aren't really discussed or, you know, the policy isn't really figured out until you're at a crisis point, in which case you're quite pressed for time. And I think different companies have different sort of thresholds as far as like what kind of response they do want to make. So there's some companies that are very vocal, and then others that prefer not to be vocal at all. So the times that they have been targeted in some sort of campaign, they would rather just sort of not really comment on it at all, whereas certainly other companies are much more maybe adept or, you know, have more significant comms sort of platforms or, you know, as part of their sort of like corporate culture or something like this, where they do want to respond head on to a particular campaign that has been waged against them. You know, I think I talked earlier about some of the sort of anti-woke, anti-ESG campaigns that have been waged online more recently. And, you know, these different companies answered these situations differently. So Target answered differently versus Disney versus Anheuser-Busch. those are just three that come top of mind because they've been sort of, these are names that have been bandied about in sort of the extremist fringe space for the last several months. So that would be my answer for a corporate, is to really take on preventative measures and have policies in place, because while you may not be a target today, you could easily become a target tomorrow.
All right, let's move on to our final question. For both of you, we'll start with Olga. What keeps you up at night?
The thing that I think about the most is, there's, I guess I'll cheat and I'll answer it two ways. One is this, you know, idea that, you know, I've spent a lot of time in some ways engaging in a game of whack-a-mole, right? I'm really proud of the work that, you know, the teams that I've worked with have done in the past, and, you know, taking down these networks that have been manipulative and deceptive. But I also think a lot about how we need to make sure that we are not just removing harm, but we're also putting something in its place. We're filling in the information environment with something valuable. You can't just remove harm, train people to spot it, and that's it. You have to find ways to get people better information and tell a better story. And we've talked a little bit about Ukraine and what the Ukrainians have done. But I think one of the most effective things we've seen is, you know, they found a way to tell a better story and in a more compelling way. They didn't bore people with numbers or reports or anything like that, but they found a way to, you know, share memes of soldiers rescuing puppies, and who doesn't want to see that, right? And who doesn't want to be on the side of the people that are rescuing the puppies as well, right? And you know, I know that's a bit flippant, but, you know, I think that there is something to be said for finding a way to help people find better information and to, you know, not just, you know, address the problems, but to also think about, you know, how we provide people with better information. The other thing that I really think about a lot is something that my old team back in the day coined, a term called perception hacking. And I worry sometimes that our worries about these problems and the elevation of these threats makes the average person not trust anything at all. One of my favorite books is Nothing is True and Everything is Possible by Peter Pomerantsev. And it is, you know, that concept, even just the title of that book, you know, when you create a society where people just don't trust anything that they read or they hear, or they don't trust their institutions, then that's where we are fundamentally, you know, at risk. And that is something that sometimes these threat actors can do, but we all together can also exacerbate those problems, because if we're constantly talking about how everything is an influence operation and we're not being clear about the evidence to support whether we actually know that a particular threat actor is behind something, we're sometimes giving them more credit than they deserve, right? We don't want to credit the Russians with everything, right? And we have to remember that institutions like democracy, elections, rule of law, all of those things exist only because we believe in them, right? Concepts like that didn't exist at the dawn of human creation. They were invented by human beings to make sense of their society and to make that society function properly. And so we have to always be investing in those things and believing in them and making sure that we don't, you know, make everything, turn everything into an influence operation. People have been lying forever.
And Regina, what about you? What keeps you up at night?
Yeah, I'll keep this pretty pithy. And I sort of alluded to this earlier. And it's really paraphrasing, again, another sort of book or author that I really admire is sort of the notion of truth from Hannah Arendt. So one thing is like, there's been lies, you know, people have been lying forever. Yes. However, there is a moment where the number of political lies and like, what does that do to a human and to the notion of a truth for a human being? And once that person no longer believes in anything and a populace no longer believes in anything, you know, those in power can kind of do what they please. So that's one thing that sort of keeps me up at night, is sort of the, you know, we're kind of operating in a space where we're wanting to show information that is true or that is accurate or that is factual. But at some point, with the bombardment of lies, people might not even really care about what is truth and what is factual, and might not have trouble believing anything. So that is something for me that keeps me up at night.
Well, this has been a really interesting and as always slightly worrying discussion. So thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. It was really, really interesting conversation, and I'm looking forward to having more like them.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really enjoyed it. And yeah, thank you, Olga. Thank you. Thank you all to our hosts.
You've been listening to How to Run a Troll Farm with Regina Morales and Olga Belaglova. Our producer for this episode was Edwin Tran, and our researchers were also your hosts, Colin Reed and me, Lewis H. Psan, as well as other unnamed members of the Encyclopedia Geopolitica team. To our audience, as always, thank you very much for listening.
If you enjoyed this show, please consider checking out our other content at Encyclopedia Geopolitica. We'd also appreciate it if you could subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, or support us on Patreon. Thanks for listening.